This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Africa is a land with endless stories to tell. From epic battles, brilliant rulers, and the dramatic rise and fall of civilizations, join us on the History of Africa podcast to learn the oft-ignored stories of the African continent. From the sands of Cairo to the plains of Zimbabwe, and from the mountains of Ethiopia to the forests of the Congo, find the History of Africa podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy.
Hey everyone, this is Trevor from the future, just chiming in with some explanation for this episode. Like the first couple of episodes, this was not intended to be a two-parter. I just didn't really understand how to manage time with multiple people on the show. So there's not a really natural part one, part two dynamic here. I also just, forgot to do ad breaks, so those aren't going to have supernatural transitions either. Hopefully it doesn't get too clunky and you still enjoy the show. So, without further ado, hello everybody, and welcome to America Secret Wars, the podcast all about the forgotten, overlooked, and deliberately buried times the United States has sent military forces to fight or occupy foreign soil. I'm your host, Trevor Cully, and for my guests today, I have Roberto and Brendan. Roberto from both the History of Sacravento, Georgia, and Brendan as his co-host on Tsar Power and occasional co-host on the History of Sacravento. How are you guys doing?
All fine and dandy here today. Glad to be part of this episode.
A little confused. I thought this was going to be about the Marvel TV show. I feel a little misled, not going to lie.
Spoiler, the ending sucked, which was weird because they had a great cast.
Yeah, I know. I didn't watch it. I didn't bother watching it.
No, that's fine. I think it's one of 30 projects they're going to bury in the next couple of months.
Yeah, probably. I mean, with Sam Jackson, it's like, I like him as an actor, but the stuff he's in is like hit or miss, like Snakes on a Plane or Deep Blue Sea.
Yeah, that's how I feel about Emilia Clarke too. And that's, those two are like 50% of that show. So when half your show is a coin toss, you're not off to a great start.
For a second there, I thought, I heard Emilia Clarke and I thought Amelia Earhart for some reason. And I was like, they made a show about Amelia Earhart with Sam Jackson in it? What?
Yeah. Amelia Earhart, famous for flying across the Pacific and playing Daenerys Targaryen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she flew across the Pacific on a dragon.
Probably would have been better than whatever planes they had in the 40s.
Well, it's probably the reason she disappeared. The dragon got hungry, so...
Probably would have made it. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Dragon versus Japanese warship. Who wins?
Dragon.
Yeah, actually, probably the Japanese warship, honestly. I mean, it would definitely take out a couple. But there's some big guns on warships.
That's fair. Well, as long as some joke about forgetting that the fleet is there. That season of Game of Thrones sucked. All right. Okay, just some reminders for the audience up top. I am also the host of History of Persia, telling the stories of ancient Iran. Obviously, this podcast is different. For one, I have guests. But also, I generally try to censor myself a bit on History of Persia. I'm not going to do that here. And I don't expect my guests to do that either. This is marked explicit for a reason. This episode probably won't get that much more explicit than we make it, but since I'm expecting some audience crossover, I wanted to give everyone another warning. The other big difference between History of Persia and Secret Wars is that Secret Wars will not go in chronological order, mostly because I assume everyone listening is broadly familiar with what the United States is and doesn't need a step-by-step explanation for most of our history. For example, in episode 1, Asha and I talked about the very first war fought by the itty-bitty baby United States, the first Oconee War between 1785 and 1790. Today, we're skipping forward by about 160 years. Roberto, Brendan, I know this is an obscure time period and not at all relevant to what we were just talking about, but do you know what the United States was getting up to in the 1940s?
Racism, segregation. That's pretty much what I can remember.
I seem to recall a war happening.
Oh, there was the Finnish War, but not the U.S. wasn't involved in that.
Yeah, that little spat we call World War II.
Never heard of it.
Whoa, what?
Yeah, it was this whole thing. There were, like, some really grumpy German people who wanted to murder all of the Jews.
Mm. Oh!
Oh, that's what the Indiana Jones movies were about. Okay, now I get it.
Oh, it's the Great Patriotic War. Now I get it.
Jesus Christ.
Yes, Tsar power rearing its head. Don't worry, Russia will show up soon. But maybe not how you're expecting. The other big feature of the European theater of that war, just to cover all our bases, was a really angry-looking little Italian man named Benito Mussolini.
Il Duce.
And yeah, we are starting with a bit of him today.
Wow, that is a hell of a guest episode to go in cold. We're just going straight to Mussolini.
Oh, don't worry. We're gonna get through him pretty quickly. Have you guys ever heard of the Free Territory of Trieste, the Race for Trieste, or the Trieste Crisis?
I've heard of Trieste in not heavy detail. I've heard of it being a thing, but that's pretty much it.
I'm guessing this place is in Italy, the only like independent territory of Italy during World War II I know of was the Republic of Salò, I think it was called. Which, it wasn't a republic, but I believe that's what it was called.
No, nothing explicitly called a republic is ever a republic. Same goes for anything that includes the words democratic or peoples in the name of the country.
Or united, for that matter, because we spent a good, 5 years not being united.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's a Republic of Georgia.
Kind of false advertising there. The mostly united, but sometimes not, states of America.
Yeah, uh-huh. In the last episode, Asha and I directly discussed two breakaway states in the first 5 years of the Union. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's actually a really common thing in the first half of American history for some Americans to be like, what if we just don't anymore? But that's not where we are today, because the Free Territory of Trieste was arguably the place where the Cold War first went hot, in 1946. Which, if you're at all familiar with the history of the Cold War, you might notice as pretty much as soon as possible.
Yeah.
What about the intervention in Archangel in Ukraine?
Archangel is in the north?
Yeah. I read about this in Reds by Ted Morgan. That was the first American attempt. That was a few months after the October Revolution.
Well, right. I was checking to make sure there wasn't another one that I had somehow missed.
Does that not count as hot?
I'm not counting it as Cold War.
Okay. I mean, it's not Cold War in the sense that it was post-World War II, but it was certainly an expression of American anxiety about the Soviet Union.
Well, it was in the early days of the Soviet Revolution, the Soviet Union, so it's just like,
yeah,
things were kind of, okay, we failed, let's forget about this and move on.
Yeah, I will have one or two episodes in the future about the times that the United States just invaded the USSR. But initially, I had intended for episode two to get into some moderately more famous wars that people have heard of but don't usually talk about. But my options were either to spend a whole episode explaining the backstory of Cold War politics, or just pick something from the beginning of the Cold War and let it stand as an explanation. Obviously, I've chosen the latter, but there were so many other more Soviet-focused, though less openly violent events happening at the time, that Trieste kind of gets buried in the overall story of the early days after World War II. I could only find one book specifically covering this event, Flashpoint Trieste by Christian Jennings, and if anybody wants to follow up on this story, I absolutely recommend it. Jennings is one of those authors that manages to write history in an almost novel-like way without compromising the factual information. So Trieste is technically Italian, like we said. But it's in that little bit of Italy above the boot that comes over the top of the Adriatic Sea. It's basically wedged in between modern Slovenia and Croatia. Because I am who I am, Trieste began its history as an Illyrian city-state sometime around 900 BC. The Illyrians were an ancient people, probably most closely related to the modern Albanians, but that's not really important right now. Just trivia, because I do ancient history.
How do they feel about Dua Lipa? Are they fans of her?
You have to assume.
Who's Dua Lipa?
She's a British Albanian singer.
Got it.
Also an Albanian nationalist, hilariously.
Oh, I did not know that. That changes a bit of perspective on her.
She got in a tiny bit of trouble on Twitter. She posted a map of Greater Albania that included Kosovo, and she tweeted it with the word, a definition of the word octothonous. I forget how to say it. I don't use this word. It just means a group of people that are indigenous to a territory.
Kosovo.
So, yeah, there's your Dua Lipa trivia.
Future friend of the show, Kosovo.
Yeah. I only know that because I just find it funny that, like, a popular pop singer is an Albanian nationalist.
Yeah, that is an unexpected heel turn from Dua Lipa. Jesus Christ. Anyway, we fast forward a few centuries, and Trieste was conquered by the Roman Republic in the 2nd century BC, and stayed Roman all the way through the early Byzantine Empire until it got taken by Charlemagne. He assigned it to an archbishop, who assigned it to a regular bishop, who assigned it to a duke, until eventually they kicked out the duke and became a commune republic sometime around the year 1200.
I'm guessing that, like, a super distorted, I hear commune, and I'm assuming like a super distorted international is coming in.
Yeah.
Is being edited in at this moment.
Yeah. The zeroth international of 1200 AD.
Yeah. Did the Paris Commune had a anthem, right? Or a song or whatever.
Oh yeah. No, medieval communes are weird because they are communes in every meaningful definition of that word, but they are not communist because they predate Karl Marx by about 500 years. Trieste then spent a couple centuries feuding with Venice over who would be the most important city for local trade. Venice won out in the end, and this is where things actually get important to our story. The Venetians never totally conquered Trieste. Eventually, they were actually just powerful enough as a kind of mercantile empire that also conquered Constantinople that they didn't really need to be at war with Trieste. But the Venetian dialect of early Italian became the dominant language in the city, meaning that Triestians are interacting a lot more with Italy, and they started to identify with the broad concept of being Italian before the actual state was formed.
Oh, forget about it.
Hey, yeah. I'm trading you.
Yes, and I'd apologize for any offense to Italy, but we're talking about you when you were fascist, so too bad. This was kind of a problem for a while, because Trieste was conquered by the Habsburg Holy Roman Empire, making this the third Roman Empire to be in charge of the city. Through some political shenanigans and another war with Venice, Trieste didn't gain independence, but they became a free imperial city, a sort of autonomous zone within the Habsburg Empire. And that's basically how things stayed as the HRE got smashed to pieces and reconfigured as the Austrian Empire because Napoleon. That lasted clear to the end of Austrian imperialism at the end of World War I, and they did briefly try to join Italy as it was becoming a thing, but the Austrians cut that off as quickly as possible. After Italy had successfully switched from the Central Powers to the Allies and continued dashing a generation of young men unsuccessfully against the same entrenched Austrian mountains for the better part of a decade, they found themselves on the winning side of the Treaty of Versailles in 1917. As part of the treaty, they got Trieste and some parts of the northern Adriatic coast that put them at odds with the newly formed country of Yugoslavia. This was really the first time that there had been a strong non-Russian Slavic state, and the first post-war settlement on the Yugoslav-Italian border wasn't great. Like any border area between ethnic groups, people mixed together in big cities, which meant that Italians were living right alongside Slovenes, and to a lesser extent, Croats, all through this region. And because it's the early 20th century, racism abounded. Italians hated Slavs, Slavs hated Italians, and basically every city in the region had a strong contingent of people who thought they were on the wrong side of the border. That gets us to the interwar period, and our main character is in Italy. So they got so fucking fascist. Just the fasciest. New fascist architecture, new fascist military garrisons, new fascist buddies up in Germany, the works.
But at least the trains run on time, supposedly.
That's a lie.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it is alleged.
Allegedly. One of history's great lies. At least Mussolini made the trains run on time. The only train that was on time was the one that took his corpse.
Nice.
Ooh, we're getting there. It's part of the story.
Yes.
Trieste was part of Benito Mussolini's very first fascist state from its inception in 1922, and actually stayed fascist until after Mussolini fell upside down from the roof of a gas station in April of 1945. See, Mussolini was a goddamn monster responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands between North Africa, Ethiopia, and Spain even before the Second World War kicked off. But Italy itself sucks at world wars. That's part of why Mussolini really wanted to control North Africa, have allies in Spain, and pretty much immediately invaded Yugoslavia with the Nazis once the war started. They needed a buffer. But that also meant they were spread thin and exhausted by the time the Allies invaded Italy proper in 1943. Germany, however, is historically pretty good at world wars, despite their losing track record, and Adolf Hitler ordered the Wehrmacht to seize and occupy northern Italy once Mussolini lost control. The Nazis had already been present in Trieste as a joint operation, and after Mussolini was gone and no longer able to push back against Nazi demands, Trieste became a hub for deporting Italian and Yugoslav Jews to the death camps. So while the main force of the Soviet Red Army was blasting most of Berlin into a fine powder, and Mussolini was getting summarily executed by a communist partisan in April of 1945, potentially the most bizarre collection of armies in European history was fighting in the race for Trieste. The Allies, famously consisting primarily of Yugoslavians, Italians, and New Zealand, battled the Axis, aka Yugoslavians, Italians, and Nazi Germany.
Wait,
so did Flight of the Conchords have a skit about this or not?
That's entirely possible.
Wait, New Zealand? Of all things.
Yes. The New Zealand 4th Infantry Battalion was the primary Allied fighting force leading the charge to Trieste from the west.
Don't mess with the Kiwis, then, I guess.
Okay. I have a serious question. Why does anyone care who controls Trieste?
At this point, they don't, really. They are just one of the last active Nazi holdouts.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But they're verging on a small problem. And I did consider asking Thomas from the history of Aotearoa New Zealand to be on this episode just because of this background information. But then I found a story about the U.S. Navy helping in the colonial wars against the Maori. So I'm going to save that call.
Okay.
You see, the big allies, America, Britain, the USSR, etc., they were all busy with Germany at the time. Most of Italy was now free of fascist control, and anti-fascist Yugoslav partisans had been fighting in and around northern Italy basically since the fascists invaded their country back in 1941. However, the Nazi occupation in northern Italy meant that fascist Italians were still in some control up there, and when those two had invaded Yugoslavia, they had set up the Chetniks, fascist Slavs to lick their jackboots, murder thousands of Jews and resistance fighters, and generally be violent assholes. This is concurrent with the Battle of Berlin, so any Axis army still fighting were mostly in it for the love of the game, hatred of anybody who wasn't a fascist, or fear that being fascist would get them shot in the street if they couldn't get some kind of favorable surrender. And that's basically the fascist goal here, is don't get Mussolini'd on sight, a goal they were all mostly in agreement on. But the Allies were getting less and less allied by the second while this was all happening. Back in February of 1945, the big three Allied leaders met in person at Yalta, Crimea, then part of the Soviet Union, Joseph Stalin representing the USSR, Winston Churchill for the United Kingdom, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt for the US. In addition to planning out the final stages of their campaign against the Nazis, they hammered out agreements for the post-war settlement in Europe and plans for the Soviets to join the American war against Japan once all this Hitler business was finished up. There were a whole bunch of agreements and compromises, mostly to do with recognizing communist states and establishing a Soviet sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. The Yalta Conference was also the first time the world leaders had established the partition of Germany into four occupation zones that they would establish after the Nazi regime was defeated. Stalin simultaneously refused to return the territory he had seized in Poland from his brief alliance with Hitler in 1939, but they said they would make reparations by giving Poland a big chunk of eastern Germany. Ironically, that chunk is most of the old Prussian kingdom that made Germany a thing in the first place. This was all building off of a secret plan made between Churchill and Stalin during the Moscow Conference the year before, where they agreed to tentative plans for how they would divide Soviet and Western influence across Eastern and Central Europe. And it was followed up by the Potsdam Conference in summer of 1945, where they drew more firm lines about partitioning territory seized by both the communist and capitalist allies. But that hadn't happened yet. So it was still in the air in April when the campaign through northern Italy was most heavily underway. And while the Italian partisans were a mix of ideologies, they were fighting under an Anglo-American occupation, and New Zealand was representing the firmly capitalist interests of the United States and Britain. But the Yugoslavian partisans were officially staunch communist fighters under the command of a guy you've probably heard of, Josip Broz,
yes,
better known by his pen name, Tito.
Wow.
Josip Tito Broz.
I didn't actually know that about Tito. I don't know anything about Yugoslavian history.
Oh, we'll get there.
Will we?
Yeah.
It'll take like 10 years.
Well, hopefully within 10 years, the audience will have been able to enjoy these products and services.
You are listening to the History of Persia podcast. And as we've been hearing from Trevor, the history of the Persian Empire is a story of Persian domination of much of the Middle East and Central Asia. But this was not the first time these lands were conquered, and it would certainly not be the last. I don't want to give too much away, but in the year 329 BCE, the important Persian city of Samarkand in modern-day Uzbekistan was conquered by some guy by the name of Alexander. But what's interesting about this city is that about 1700 years later, this same city, Samarkand, would be the glowing capital of an empire forged by a man known as Timur, or Tamerlane, or simply Timur. And Timur has gone down in history as a fantastic tactician, a man who supposedly never lost a battle, a great patron of the arts, and one of the most brutal conquerors of all time. From about 1365 until 1405 CE, Timur was almost constantly at war, building for himself an empire that stretched from modern-day Turkey to India, from Syria to the Russian steppe, and I want to know how and why this happened. If that sounds interesting to you and you want the story of Timur told by a guy who talks too fast and has loud neighbors, then check out my show, The Timur Podcast. Find out more about it at timurpodcast.com or listen to it in most places where you find podcasts. And with that said, take it away, Trevor.
Do you guys know how he got the name Tito?
The vodka.
Yeah, duh. You love vodka.
Yes. I do also wonder if there's vodka. A connection there. No, as far as anybody knows, it was just a really common nickname, and he used it as a pen name while writing for communist zines.
I mean, makes sense.
Huh.
I feel like if you're gonna pick a name, go the stolid route. Call yourself Joseph Steele. No, Tito.
I mean, Stalin's nickname growing up was Koba.
That is true.
What does that mean?
We'll get there.
No, tell me now.
It's a Georgian historical figure.
Okay. Well, anyway, I find it funny that, you know, he just chose a common nickname as it became an ideology, like Titoism. Like, imagine, like, Nickism.
Trevorism.
Or Joeism. Or Freddyism.
Oh, just wait. Because Josip was the son of struggling middle-class farmers who had flunked out of second grade at the age of 12 and became interested in socialist politics because he took up a trade apprenticeship in Eastern Europe during the early 1900s.
Wow, so you could have a middle-class existence by flunking out of second grade. How the times have changed.
I mean, I gotta imagine second grade in the early 1900s, that's the life experience and maturity level of like a 30-year-old today, right? Nobody lived an easy life back then.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not in Yugoslavia, or I guess, I don't know which pre-Yugoslav country he was born in. I think Slovenia. He was radicalized from a social democrat to full-on Soviet communist via being forced to fight for the Austrians during World War I, and he adopted Tito while writing for an illegal Yugoslav Communist Party zine during the 1930s. But his comrades in the Comintern generally knew him as Walter before he rose to prominence as a partisan warlord fighting the fascist invasion.
That's incredible. Walter.
Walter.
Walter. Okay, so Tito was born in Croatia, but died in Slovenia. Mm.
And I mostly provide Tito's background here because it's very silly, but keep some of it in mind because Tito's personal politics will become very important by the end of the episode.
Yeah, I mean, you say that his beginning is silly, and it is, but all I can think of is like the incident where he threw people into a pit alive.
No, he's a terrible monster.
Well, I think there were Nazis that were throwing into a pit alive, so it's not that bad, but still.
Yeah, there's some, we'll get there, there's some iffy things about who counted as a Nazi in Tito's Yugoslavia.
Oh, okay, I see.
But, you know, he flunked out of second grade and was called Walter by the Comintern. Like, it is funny.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Walter! You read the manifesto yet? No, comrade.
I think the answer was probably more like, which one?
Which one, comrade? Yes.
So, in late April of 45, Tito's forces were breaking through the Axis defenses in western Slovenia while the Allies were working their way through northeastern Italy. On the 28th, realizing that their time was probably up, the Italian fascists handed over control of the city to the Public Health Committee, which was actually a centrist political element within Trieste, if you can call compromising with the Axis centrist, which I guess it is these days. But some stayed behind, some of the fascists, as did many of the Yugoslav Chetniks, who frankly just had nowhere to run. The Public Health Commission entered into negotiations with the National Liberation Committee, the local anti-fascist resistance movement, who openly refused to compromise because there's only one type of good fascist. This devolved into an open gun battle between the Italian resistance, the Committee for Public Health, and the Axis occupation forces in the streets of the city.
Wow. When you say open gun battle, I'm assuming you mean like a debate got so heated, somebody drew a pistol and another person drew a pistol and it just sort of spiraled out of control from there.
Yeah, it is not clear where exactly things broke down.
I'm just imagining like a cowboy shootout.
That is what it reads like.
Cowboys didn't have Brownings, they had Colts, but you do you.
I don't know, the cowboys I know have any kind of gun you can get your hands on.
Yeah, they got Colts in this war too. That is more true today than ever.
Yeah. I'm just saying, I just recall that Brownings were popular in Italy.
Oh, yes. Well,
around this period. I don't know if they used Brownings, so gun nerds don't break my balls over this one. I don't care.
God only knows what they're using, whatever's left at this point. Then, on April 30th, 1945, two very important things happened. First, Adolf Hitler commanded everyone in the Führer bunker to find some way of committing suicide before painting his own bedroom, whatever color the inside of his skull happened to be.
Green.
Second?
Yeah, green. Or whatever color syphilis turns your head.
Squishy.
It was all black and white back then.
Oh, true, true, true. So it's chocolate syrup.
Oh, yeah. Color didn't exist.
Second, the partisan Yugoslav Fourth Army arrived at Trieste and began sending infiltration units into town. The next morning, they began their full assault on the city, fighting bizarre isolated pockets of beleaguered German and Chetnik forces, receiving aid from the local anti-fascists, and occasionally getting into shootouts with the local Committee for Public Health. Just the most bizarre armed organization imaginable.
Is it healthy to be armed? I mean, this time I guess it is.
It's World War II, so...
Well, they're eradicating, you know, the fascist disease.
Yeah. The only cure for fascism.
Yeah, getting rid of vermin.
such as rats and fascists.
You said the same thing twice. On the morning of May 2nd, the New Zealanders and their Italian allies arrived just in time to watch the Yugoslav communists engage in a two-hour urban firefight with Nazis and to accept the surrender of the fleeing Chetniks, who absolutely did not want to turn themselves in to Tito and their communist countrymen. By May 4th, the very last pockets of fascist resistance in the city had surrendered to one Allied army or another, and everyone received word that West Berlin had surrendered to the Americans. The formal Nazi surrender and VE Day would come a week later. The next few weeks were chaotic in Trieste. The Allies did not want to lose any ground to the communist, and some American generals actually called for an assault against the Yugoslav occupation forces and in the wider Venezia-Julia region. Neither Churchill nor Harry Truman, just a few weeks into his presidency after FDR's death, wanted to accidentally start a full-blown war with the communist bloc over this city. At the end of May, an actual British army arrived and Tito met with a British ambassador, Sir William Duthie Morgan. Right? It's so British.
Duthie
Morgan.
Was Duthie a nickname?
No, as far as I can tell, like that is his Christian name is William Duthie.
God. So British people will literally carry a child for 6 months and name him Duthie.
So British people reproduce in 6 months?
Sorry, yeah. Child for 9 months.
Do you know something about British people that we don't?
No wonder they're everywhere.
They met to determine the boundaries for a partition of the Venezia Giulia as a de facto autonomous zone split between Western and Yugoslav occupation. The Yugoslav administration would take control of the southern territory, and the Western allies took the north, closer to Italy. This agreement, called the Morgan Line, also ceded a huge chunk of the Venezia Giulia to Yugoslavia outright to avoid conflict, since Tito's forces had already liberated and occupied it during the war. Tito naturally wanted more, but William Duthie drew a blue line on the map, stating firmly that Yugoslav forces were not to cross it. And the southern end of that line ran right through the southern third of the city of Trieste. Tito held out until a British armored division started approaching that line, at which point he caved and ended up ceding actually a little ground back to the Italians in the formal final agreement.
Damn Brits.
You know, when it was just New Zealand providing military presence, he thought he might have something, and then the actual British army showed up.
How dare they? Ruining everything.
And doing what Brits do and just drawing a line on the map and being like, these are the borders now.
Mm-hmm.
In the time between these two agreements, the world changed irrevocably. Stalin, Truman, and Churchill met once again at the Potsdam Conference, only for Churchill to lose an election midway through the meeting and be replaced as prime minister by the less bellicose Clement Attlee. Truman was still finding his footing and had to keep his big plans for the Pacific Theater under wraps while still making sure he had Soviet support in Asia if things didn't work out. At Potsdam, East Germany was split into Soviet control, and the three world powers hammered out preliminary bounds for their spheres of influence. Then, literally just 4 days after the conference ended, the world changed in another way when Hiroshima, Japan was wiped off the face of the earth in a blast of nuclear hellfire. 3 days later, the United States dropped their second nuke on Nagasaki, and within a week, Japan had surrendered to the United States, ending World War II.
Way to go off a bang.
Yeah. This had the added benefit of making sure that the United States would not have to partition Japan between themselves and Soviet control. And it allowed China to resume its focus on its own civil war between the quote-unquote Republican forces of Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong's Communist Party. Korea was split north and south, Japan was occupied by the US, and most of Europe, including Trieste, remained in a weird gray area as the Allies moved towards the next stage of post-war settlement, the Paris Peace Conference. Hammering out exactly what New World Order would look like. This began in July of 1946 and would last until October. And it's also somehow the third fucking Treaty of Paris I've mentioned in two episodes.
How many Treaty of Paris's are there?
Too many.
Damn French.
Plans were officially made to partition Trieste as an autonomous occupied state administered under the auspices of the newly formed United Nations. Remember, the UN is brand new at this, so people still thought that it might be able to do things.
Bless their hearts.
Yeah, it didn't work out. And it didn't work out in part because the Soviet Union gave itself three seats. But that's beside the point. They tried to give themselves 17. Tensions were still running high in occupied Trieste. American tanks were a regular sight on the street, and checkpoints were stopping people less to watch for remaining fascist supporters and more to control the flow of goods and supplies into Eastern Europe. Trieste is a major port, and its capacity to control the rebuilding effort for much of the Eastern Bloc was a key part of its strategic value, and supplies were already in short supply.
Okay, so that's why everyone cared about Trieste.
Trieste.
Or, sorry, is it Trieste?
Or Trieste? Or just Trieste is how most English speakers have
Trieste.
Said it.
Trieste. Okay. Okay. So yeah, there is a valid reason to care about it. It does have strategic value.
It absolutely does. It just was not anybody's priority at the end of the war. Now, this left political tensions running high. Not only did both occupation forces have to deal with the plain fact that some Italians were still in the Slavic zone and some Slovenians were still in the Allied zone, but even many of the Italians in this region were staunch communists. Titoist flags were flown in the Allied occupation, and pro- or anti-Slovenian slogans were painted on the sides of buildings all the time. And I have to ask you guys, with the knowledge you have of this episode up to this point, how many beheadings do you think are involved in this story?
Quite a few.
I'm sorry, what? Hopefully none.
Let's read the next sentence.
15!
And none of this was at all helped by the fact that a Gurkha, a Nepalese colonial soldier in the British Army, fucking beheaded a Yugoslav soldier in November of 1945.
Oh. That's no bueno.
Why? Jesus.
Quote from Flashpoint Trieste. "We've had a spot of bother," said the Major Khan, a British Sikh.
British people will genocide an entire people and be like, "Oh, there's a spot of trouble."
Yeah, this is direct quotes from a diary, just reframed in a kind of novel-like format. So yes, "we've had a spot of bother. One of my Gurkhas has beheaded one of their chaps." Sergeant Norden said nothing. He immediately saw that this was going to escalate fast and viciously. "Yes," said the officer, "one of my Gurkhas has beheaded one of their chaps. They've removed the fellow's body, and they're looking for his head now, in the river."
Why did he behead them, hidden though? Okay, keep going.
It's coming. The officer shrugged his shoulders. "It's all right, Sergeant. My chap did it in self-defense. You can ask him. He's over here."
Of course it was self-defense. I say that sarcastically.
Yeah. And, you know, we dropped a bomb on Japan in self-defense.
Yeah, this was in slightly less self-defense than that. Standing grim-faced and shaken, with his back to a sentry box by the river, was a young Gurkha soldier. "It," he said, "started in a friendly enough way. A few of the partisans were on their way back from a local bar and had stopped and offered him a sip of their plum brandy."
Slivovice.
Called Silvovich.
Slivovice.
Silvovich? I will let you take control of that one. And I will let the sponsors of this show take control of the podcast for the next 90-ish seconds.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
The Gurkha, not liking to be offered a drink while on duty, had taken offense. When one of the partisans had tried to take the Gurkha's kukri knife, he had reacted and cut the man's head off. So yeah.
I'm sorry, it's just a very unreasonable reaction to being offered a drink. Like, I know you shouldn't drink on duty, but you don't have to just say no.
Okay, Nancy Reagan. No, actually, the Reagans would cut your head off. Don't try to take a guy's culturally important knife off of his belt. But also, like...
Yeah, you shouldn't do that also.
Like, yeah, just say no. Don't... Because you get the sense there's a missing component here where he did something but after taking offense.
Oh my god, it just clicked on me that you said Nepalese, not Napalese Gurkhas. I'm like, I didn't know Italians had Gurkhas. What is going on? I was just like, oh wait. Yeah.
The British colonial forces in Naples.
I do 100% believe that he managed to behead a guy with just a kukri. That I believe.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, read any story about the Gurkha forces in World War II. They were terrifying.
Oh my god, yes. I love them.
But, yeah, a couple of drunk Slovenian partisans were stumbling back to their barracks near the demarcation line, offered a Gurkha a drink on duty, and this escalated to a beheading, which was on the verge of an open firefight by the time that Sergeant Norden arrived to de-escalate the situation. He managed to talk down the Yugoslav commissar who turned up demanding blood for blood by pointing out that any escalation could spark another world war. And if you remember, they'd just finished one of those. The thing is, it got worse when word of the incident reached the Red Army High Command, and Soviet occupation forces started marching in with every intent of attacking the Allies, leaving this poor bastard Norden, a low-ranking non-commissioned officer, to find a way out. He chose to withdraw all Allied forces from the border zone from the time being, radio back to headquarters explaining what had happened, and hope that averting war was a good enough reason for countermanding his orders.
So what I'm hearing is it's the Brits' fault once again.
It was this one Gurkha's fault.
Yeah, it's...
He was so offended by the notion that someone would offer him a drink.
While on duty, but he's a British soldier. Under the British command, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, a random Gurkha almost, you know, had a damn foolish incident in the Balkans.
I mean, that's just no more day in the Balkans. Damn foolish incident?
Yeah, but there are only a few moments where that damn foolish incident can start a world war. And weirdly, there are several of those.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right.
Now, Winston Churchill didn't help things either with his public address to the United States on March 5th. Trieste actually features in the most famous line of the speech given at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. And I can't do a good Churchill voice, but from Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
Because of the Zagurka.
I do kind of want to, not to say that, I'm going to go listen to some speeches and see if I can get an impression down, because it seems like a fun one to do.
Oh, if you can pull off a good Churchill voice, it's great. The only thing I can really do is say Nazis.
Oh, man.
So Trieste was on everybody's mind in 1946 and was actively seen as the front line of the developing Cold War. There was also another sort of ethnic tension appearing all over Europe in 1946. And I want to quote from the diaries of Ron Goldstein, a British corporal stationed in Trieste, who wrote extensively for the BBC and on his own blog about his experiences, and actually just passed away in 2021 at the age of 98.
Damn.
I was a little confused. You said blog, and I was like, they didn't have blogs back then. They had columns.
No, he was a 70-year-old World War II veteran, and he started a blog about his experiences.
Blogs have been started for much worse reasons.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't find any confirmation one way or the other on this, but from the stories he tells, I do think that Ron Goldstein was a British Jew. I just couldn't find it that actually written in any of his works anywhere.
Yeah, I was going to ask if he was Jewish, because that last name signaled to me that he was.
Yeah, the last name is very Jewish.
But also, you know, maybe he's like, just doesn't care.
Right. It's still kind of hard to tell from the stories that he tells, but I think this first one kind of lends credence to that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, he didn't give us any, you know, he didn't give us any clues like, oh, I was playing dreidel on my way to synagogue when I saw a booby and, you know, string of Yiddish words.
About that. On 16th April, my very good friend Leslie Gilbert and I attended Passover service at the Meritma on the harbor front of Trieste. A fair amount of local civilians attended the service organized by an Austrian who had been released from a concentration camp and his two daughters. The service was about halfway through when there was a clamor at one of the doors. Some further concentration camp victims had arrived in the area and heard of the service that was taking place. To our shame, the local Jewish army chaplain who was present wanted to keep them out, insisting that army rations had only been issued for those expected. Fortunately, for good sense, he was soon told in no uncertain terms that all those present would refuse to eat if the newcomers were not allowed in, and the evening proceeded without any further problems.
That's a heartwarming story.
It is, actually.
Yeah, that's good, right? Despite strained provisions, the local occupation forces yelled at the chaplain to not be an asshole to Holocaust victims.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, here's Ron's diary entry from May. Among the few civilians I knew in Trieste was the Austrian Amgott worker I had met at the Passover service. I was at his house one evening, and one of his daughters was just about to leave to visit another friend. Because the streets of Trieste were not altogether safe after dark, he asked me to escort her to her destination, and I was happy to oblige. And if this was written in modern terminology, I would not be using the accent for this, but it doesn't make sense in an American accent.
Well, he's Austrian, right? So,
well, no. No.
The writer is British. Yeah, this friend... Yeah.
Oh, wait, no, this guy's British.
Yeah.
Sorry, the writer's British, right.
But I will dispense with it for this next part, because we had just got into the street outside his flat when we literally stumbled over a body on the curb. The young girl, I can't remember her name, was very distressed, but able to identify the dead person as another Jew who lived in the flat above her own. She asked me to telephone the police from a nearby bar, and she had no phone in her flat. I escorted her back to the home we had just left. A few days later, I called her home again to find out what had happened and was told that the police believed the dead man had committed suicide by jumping from the roof. So that's fucked up.
Yeah. Just walk out and see a dead body.
That is... That is...
I don't know.
The environment for Jews in Trieste in 1946.
That seems a bit of a suspicious suicide, to be honest.
It's very Russian, if you think about it.
I mean, you can't...
Is this Jew Russian?
I don't think so.
I
would not fault anybody for surviving the Holocaust and coming out incredibly depressed on the other side.
I don't know. I mean, a Jew in this this environment dying and then just being immediately ruled a suicide, I don't know.
Yeah, I would not also be surprised if there were a bunch of Chetniks still living in the city at this point. So, yeah, it is not a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
Ron Goldstein also reports how in July and August of 1946, the British Army had to crack down on a smuggling ring within its own ranks, selling equipment to the Yugoslav occupation on the other side of the Morgan Line. And rations were still being carefully handed out by occupying soldiers on both sides. Ron personally reported this incident to his commanding officers after uncovering a cache of contraband, including the tires for an armored car. Ron Goldstein's encounter with this smuggling ring also coincided with the most dramatic events of the Triestian occupation. On July 12th, three Yugoslav soldiers crossed into the Allied occupation zone. This small incursion was almost certainly an accident, but when the American border guards were sent to investigate, the Yugoslavs opened fire on sight, prompting the Americans to return fire, killing a third of the supposed Yugoslav invasion force. Both sides called in reinforcements, and the reinforcing soldiers actually ran into each other en route, prompting the entire Yugoslav reinforcement group to withdraw. Then, on August 9th, a U.S. Army Air Force transport plane flying near the border between the occupation zones was intercepted by Yugoslav fighters, shot at and forced to land in Yugoslav territory, with the entire crew taken prisoner. This American plane was a C-47, basically an up-armored commercial airliner with no weapons capabilities on board. There had been minor exchanges between American and Soviet forces during World War II, usually during moments of poor battlefield communication, but this was the first time where communist forces had fired on American troops in an official, intentional action. Then, on August 18th, a massive explosion rocked the Allied occupation zone. Over 200 people, largely civilians, were killed when three torpedo warheads, four demolition charges, and five smokescreen generators detonated on Vergarola Beach. An exact cause was never determined, but the Allied investigation concluded the blast had to be intentional, and it was widely speculated to be either the work of Yugoslav spies or pro-communist partisans within the Allied occupation zone. Well, as if a catastrophic explosion just days after an unarmed flight crew was taken hostage wasn't enough, another US C-47 was shot down by Yugoslav fighters over the border the day after the Vergarola explosion. It is unclear whether the transport plane tried to escape or evade the Yugoslav forces, but they shot that motherfucker right out of the sky. Five crew were killed, including a civilian, and the remaining seven passengers were taken prisoner upon crashing, and their plane basically split in half on Yugoslav soil. So not great, not exactly ideal peacetime interaction between the two sides. This series of events coincided with other layers of ever-increasing tension as the Allies transitioned to enemies in the growing Cold War between the West and the Communist bloc. The Chinese Civil War had returned to full-scale attacks, and Chiang Kai-shek was actively invading communist territory at the time. The partition of Germany was still new, and anti-communist civilians and Jewish Holocaust survivors were smuggling themselves out of East Germany into the Western occupation zones. But most importantly at the moment, Stalin was demanding joint Soviet and Allied occupation of the Black Sea Straits, technically all within the borders of Turkey, which was a Western ally.
Well, you mentioned Turkey. I guess it's time for one of my signature anti-Erdogan rants.
Do you have a problem with the absolutely democratically elected leader of modern Turkey who definitely faced a very real coup a few years ago?
We have a minor problem. Somehow my hatred for Erdogan has, like, intersected in multiple interests I've had. For a while, I followed the democratic experiment in Rojava, and that made me hate Turkey because of their meddling. And also, Azerbaijan was bombing Armenia again. Armenians, rather. And again, this made me hate Turkey.
I'm more pissed off with the Hagia Sophia.
Yeah, there's also, aligning yourself with the right wing of...
fundamentalists and all that.
Yeah, aligning yourself with the right wing of I don't know if there's a Muslim party in Turkey. Aligning yourself with fundamentalist Muslims in Turkey by declaring the Hagia Sophia a mosque again, and undermining a lot of work that was done to improve relations between Christians and Muslims and secularists. So, yeah. I hate Erdogan.
Ah, Turkey, for when your secular state doesn't want to be secular anymore.
Ataturk would be pissed.
Ataturk can also go fuck himself.
Oh, absolutely, but like...
I mean...
He wouldn't like Erdogan either.
All the defenders of Ataturk online are the same people who defend Erdogan. If you say Ataturk sucks, then you'll get spammed with, like, pictures of dead Kurds in your mentions.
Yeah, for the official record of, I don't know, the world, Hopful Media believes that the various genocides against Kurds and Armenians actually fucking happened, because they did.
They did.
He wasn't Turkish. He was from Tikrit in Iraq, but I did meet a Kurdish genocide denier last month.
Oh, Jesus Christ. All right, but that's not one of the genocides that is on the table for today. There's just other ones to talk about. But in this case, the Black Sea Straits have been a central aspect of Russian politics, literally since before there were proper Russians. The Bosporus and Dardanelles, aka the Hellespont for my History of Persia listeners, provide two natural choke points for any trade between the Mediterranean and the Black Sea. The Western allies, especially Truman, staunchly opposed ceding any control over this strategic resource to Stalin, and both sides actively deployed naval forces in the region. Fortunately, something that would never happen ever again. Don't look at the news. But something that will happen again is all of you listening to this podcast, because this is where we will leave off for today. Next week, part two will pick right back up here like nothing ever happened, because this is Trevor from the future, and nothing ever did. I will be doing my friends' plugs for them, because you'll see at the end of episode 2, it's not quite as easy to copy and paste this time. You really should go listen to Czar Power and follow them on social media at Czar Power Pod. You should also listen to The History of Saakartvelo, Georgia, and follow Roberto at History_Georgia, wherever fine usernames are sold. And you can follow Brendan and find all of his projects at Foster_writing on Twitter, or brendanfoster.bsky.social on Blue Sky. For more information about this show, you can go to hopfulmedia.com or secretwarspod.com and follow me on social media at History of Persia, because I'm not going to manage two social media accounts. Until next time, go listen to the History of Persia, I guess. Or go back and listen to episodes 1 and 2 of this show. They're good. Go listen. See ya!
Africa is a land with endless stories to tell. From epic battles, brilliant rulers, and the dramatic rise and fall of civilizations, join us on the History of Africa podcast to learn the oft-ignored stories of the African continent. From the sands of Cairo to the plains of Zimbabwe, and from the mountains of Ethiopia to the forests of the Congo, find the History of Africa podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy.